This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?"
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening. Wherever you are in the world, I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I am feeling like I have purpose and I am driven and I am passionate.
Ooh.
And you and I are definitely art geeks. And I have a feeling that our wonderful guest today is also a bit of an art geek. I think she's actually cooler than us. Way cooler.
Yes. An art geek trio.
Yeah, but she is very inspiring human being. She has studied art history and is an art critic and curator and has even put on exhibitions all over London in different venues.
And she's only 26.
Yeah, I know. Or 27. Yeah, 26, 27. We'll have to ask, actually.
We'll have to check.
But at the age of 20, our guest wrote for the Financial Times, and she's a sort of major achiever in the art world, and we are both big fans of hers. And recently, our guest wrote an amazing article in The Independent, which is partly how this episode has materialized, because we were so inspired by her writing. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art, Andrea Emmalife.
How are you?
Hi.
I'm great.
How old
very
are you?
Happy this morning. How old am I? I'm 26.
I was right, sorry, you were wrong, Rob. You were aging her up. That was me.
I know. You can't add years on me like that.
Rob, it wasn't me. How are you today? Where are you today? Where are you in the world?
I'm at home. I'm in London, and I'm feeling really sort of inspired as well. I enjoyed your intro. I'm feeling good, and I feel like the world is opening up, and it's been a good week. How about you guys?
The same. I feel like for the art world, it feels like it's opening up. We're into the start of July, and now getting notifications and emails every day that the Tate's opening up and the Barbican's opening up and the Whitechapel, and it feels like the art world, the museums, culture is starting to ease off, and that's a really exciting time, and especially for you being an art critic and an art writer.
Yeah, this is probably the biggest or the longest time I've gone without seeing art, and it's really strange because I was still writing and researching and reading, but there's just a real different sense of how you relate to art where you can't see it. It's weird working in the art world when art isn't available. Does it exist when we're not looking at it? Who knows?
Is it like, do you hear a tree fall if you're not near it?
It's exactly. Like that,
it? Did you check out online shows, and how did you feel about like the art fairs online?
I did a bit. I found the art fairs a bit difficult. I mean, online viewing rooms are just not the same. And even some things that lend itself to the medium of technology, like digital art, I just feel like it's not intended for my 15-inch screen. I think it really is way more contemplative when it's in a room on your own, and it's almost like going to church and you're seeing like an amazing video. Although I did enjoy watching Arthur Jaffa's Lover's Message film when it was screened across all the museums. Platforms, that was great.
Yes, agreed.
That was
and also, I think
necessary for what's going on now.
Yeah, definitely. I also feel like it's so difficult to sort of understand what a painting is if you're seeing it, or even a sculpture, or any artwork really, if you're seeing it just through a screen, because artwork kind of sometimes has an aura about it, you know, like a energy. Or a, yeah. And I just think I find it very frustrating, like all the online viewing rooms. But you're an art advisor too,
especially. Yeah, a bit. So I do that a little bit, because I'm really interested in emerging artists, and I really enjoy bringing that to life for people that don't know so much about it, or I guess have a bit of a disconnect to it. There's some amazing art being created at the moment, and I guess it's also excited me because a lot of them are my peers. So I love championing them, and I think there's going to be a really good resurgence of a couple of new mediums coming up. So, yeah. So everyone's been quite busy during lockdown too.
Right. Yes. I mean, have you been watching your friends get really proactive in this period, like artistically, and really channel anxieties into the work? Do you feel like their work's changing and it's going to be more politicized, or...?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen artists work in different mediums because of, you know, studio restraints, which I think is quite interesting, because there's this idea of change and sort of disruption catalyzing new thought. And so I've had, you know, friends that are sculptors who can't make these sort of really large kinetic machines. My friend Harrison Pierce does this stuff, and he's taken to painting. And I think there is something that is exciting about, you know, approaching new mediums and new ideas in a different way, especially when it's come across very organically. I've also seen artists engage with what's going on now as well. One of my good friends, Ollie Epp, has been making paintings about the quarantine more prevalent in the beginning, which was interesting. And I've been following some other artists, like Mark Quinn, I saw was doing a series on, it was a viral painting. So it was looking at all the newspaper articles and blowing them up into sort of 3-meter-sized paintings, which I found really interesting, because I think during this time, we've all been kind of glued to our phones looking at the news updates, whether what's going on with the health crisis, or what Britney's been doing in burning down her gym.
Yeah.
And
the so candle, those paintings. Yeah.
Exactly. So those paintings reference all of that, and the sort of social zeitgeist that's been going on, because it's quite an incredible time. And I think looking back, there will be, I don't know, it'd be interesting to see what has come from this time and how it's encapsulated in art history.
Yeah, definitely.
Totally.
And actually, talking about Ollie Epp, who you just mentioned, aren't you involved with like a residency?
Yeah, so me and Ollie, he's one of my good friends, and we ran a residency last year, and it was really incredible. It was part of my sort of pledge to emerging artists, and we provided free studio space for 5 artists every month from so many different countries. We had like maybe 14 different countries get involved. So we did that together. But this year, obviously, that plan's been scuppered a little bit because travel isn't possible so much. And it's on hold. I'd love to do it again, though. There's something really inspiring and warming about, you know, discovering artists from other countries and them coming here and them intermingling. And it's cool.
That's so generous of you.
The kind guy. Yeah.
That's really generous. So how did you, was it a success? I mean, and what countries were they coming from?
And it's called Plop Residency, isn't it?
It's called Plop Residency. And we had maybe 14 countries, as far as like Chile and Pakistan and Egypt, but as close as France and Denmark and Germany, and many from the States also. It was a very mixed bag every month. So we'd have sculptors, performance artists, painters, people working in like AI, and they all just sort of shared the studio. It was a bit like Big Brother, though. I quite enjoyed seeing how they get on and what dramas unfold and or didn't, etc. But I really miss
would
it.
You be, would
miss
you be like headmistress going round? You'd be like headmistress going around.
I'd like popping in being like, so how's everyone doing?
And everyone would panic. Yeah. Like Simon Cowell's turned up of the art world. Yeah.
Love that.
That's amazing. What is it about emerging artists for you that is the route you want to get involved in the art world?
Emerging artists, I think it's just the idea of possibility. And also, it's such an exciting period of I mean, of development as an artist. There's so much changing, so many ideas being bounced back and forth. I just find the conversations and the interchanges at that stage really interesting. There's also such a vibrancy in the artists because they're really discovering what they want to do and like their approaches. And seeing how fast they can grow as well is great. I think, yeah, that's probably the main bit. And also, there's just a sort of immediacy with the work too. Like I love jumping into the studios and seeing, you know, that it's sort of outside of the market in some ways because they're just making and they're not thinking so much. Like a lot of them haven't got gallery representation. Right. So there's an immediacy and a rawness that I enjoy. And then it's also great seeing them succeed and how that progresses. But yeah, there's some great artists. Emerging is such an interesting term though, because it can mean so many different things. Emerging could be just out of art school. You could still be emerging sort of 10 to 20 years later. So there's a big area. I know some friends who I think are definitely emerged and they would think otherwise. So that's interesting too. I was going to ask if you have any favourite emerging artists.
Yes, we definitely do. Yeah, yeah. So Russell and I are looking all the time. I mean, I actually bought a work yesterday from a charity auction by a young... is she based in London, Ross?
Yeah, she's in Brixton.
Sola
Ololodu.
What's her name? Oh, I know her. Yeah. She's great.
You met her?
She's got such a great energy. Yes, I have. She did. She didn't do the residency, but she's a good friend of the residency. A lot of her friends have done it, so I've met her many times. She's got great energy and her work is brilliant.
Yeah, she gave works to the Stephen Lawrence Foundation.
Ah, yeah, brilliant, great.
Yeah, Russ and I both got a work by her. And there's a website called Auction Art, like Auk Art, which seems to sell a lot of work by younger and emerging kind of artists from colleges and things like that. And they're doing this,
which I think will be very necessary with the lack of graduate shows this year.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is such a shame for these artists.
We've been brainstorming trying to work out a way to help one of the colleges in London to see whether we can do something in Margate. It's almost confirmed. I really hope it happens.
So let's talk about how you came to massive attention of us and something that's been a really, really important kind of mission statement that you wrote a few weeks back about how the art world can step up for Black lives. And this piece is so important, beautifully written, powerful. And it feels like a really perfect time for us to be talking about this right now. And so what can we do? What now for the art world? And how do you feel like the art world has rallied behind the current Black Lives Matter movement? And going forwards, what change can we hope for?
So to track back to the article, I think the article started when, I guess, after the death of George Floyd, I think everyone was obviously very moved and Instagram was full of videos and just sort of pledges. And that was very exciting. But then I felt that it reignited the conversation about visibility of minorities in the art world. And so I'm a woman of color, I'm a Black woman, and I'm a curator and a writer and all these things, but I am one of very few. It's a very small pool of people. And it's something I've been thinking about for a very long time. And I thought this is the right moment to get this message across. People are listening. And so I think the success of the article, and it was really successful. I mean, I was so humbled by the amount of times it was shared when it went live. My Instagram kind of blew up a little bit. It was constantly being reshared. I had lots of emails and comments, and that, I guess, confirmed that this is something that is good to talk about. But the success of the article, I think, hinged a lot on the great interviewees I was able to talk to. I spoke to Courtney J. Martin, who's director of Yale Center in New Haven, who's incredibly inspiring. Eva Langret, who's the artistic director of Freeze, Ose Bonsu from Tate, Sapake from INEVA, which is a great institution that focuses on the visibility of Black and Asian artists within museum collections. It was a great sort of learning point as well for me, because I'm still new into the art world, and so there are some historical sort of backstops and points that I wasn't aware of as well, in terms of how much has changed already, but still how much needs to change. And something I touched upon in the article, I guess the first point is art education. For art history, for example, I studied at the Courtauld. I was maybe one of five in like the last decade or longer in the course, which is five people of colour. And that was pretty outstanding.
One of five in the last decade?
Yeah, one of five black students, not people of colour. Yeah, in the BA course at the Courtauld.
I haven't fact-checked it, but
I've spoken to many, many students, and they've confirmed that is, you know, pretty much the case. If it's not that, sure it's very, very low. But I can't speak as to after I've left, but I think it's probably not changed much. But that kind of rolls in round through many other art history degrees as well. So I guess the question is also, how do you get into an arts job if you don't have the education to start with? And then I guess how do you encourage studying art history within these demographics as well? I was very lucky to fall into it because I loved art history as a kid, but not really encouraged by my parents. I was just very much an anomaly.
Art teacher, didn't you, when you was at college?
I had an amazing art teacher that really changed it around. But like, if I hadn't gone to that school, for example, I got a bursary to a fee-paying school. If I hadn't been there, I really don't know if I would have turned into this person. These action points when you're young are extremely important. And I guess, how do you visualize yourself as, I don't know, the head of Tate or the head of a curator, a museum director, when you can't see them in the roles as well? I've been talking to many people about this, and how do you action it? I guess you encourage art history studying from a younger age, I guess, or I guess even just the visibility of people in those roles now is encouraging. But the first starting point, I guess, is in the new generation. And I guess that's part of what I'm really passionate about dedicating myself to, is hopefully inspiring some other young Black women or men to get into this as well. Because, as I said before, it's really difficult to imagine yourself as something if there's no pointer.
Role models or like mentors.
Yeah. Or it's so crucial. I feel a bit weird calling myself a role model. But you are, though,
Andrea, you are. And it's so crucial to have an increase in the visibility of Black curators, Black historians, Black gallerists. It's like so, so important. And so you're saying that you want, like, can you visualize yourself as a head of the Tate? Can you do that? Is that a sort of world you want to go into, where you want to be running a gallery, or do you think you want to stay more on the journalistic side of the art world and support it?
Oh gosh, I have no idea. I have a lot of different ideas. I like wearing many hats, as you can tell. I think my biography is always very all over the place. I would love to run an institution. I have this vision of like putting like a studio museum Harlem in London. I think that would be so exciting.
Our Thelma Golden. That'd be genius.
I want to do that. She's also so chic, which is great. I would love to do that. So do I imagine myself as the head of Tate? Not really. But do I imagine myself running a space that is, you know, encouraging
amplifying voices art
and amplifying voices? Definitely. And I think I'd also like to bolster that with my writing still, because I love writing so much.
Well, you're brilliant.
And so I really don't think I could stop.
Those two skills
that
can you know, sit side by side totally. You know, it's really important, actually, because I think that's how the vision of an organization, you know, can be translated to a wider audience, if you can actually write it down and explain so clearly, like you write, you know, to an audience. There was a part of your article in The Independent that I was really touched by, which was Courtney J. Martin, the director of the Yale Center for British Art in Connecticut. And you interviewed Courtney, and Courtney said this thing about cultivating successors. So like current museum leaders, current gallery directors, you know, all different people in the art world should be cultivating their successors. And your successors need to be from different backgrounds and, you know, a wide range of people, because otherwise that if you don't have that kind of plurality of people, then nothing's going to change, but it'll just stay stagnant. And I found that quote so kind of striking, in the sense that that is what we need to do now. We don't just need to like be posting images on social media, because actually, yes, it shows that you're aligned to a cause and that you are standing in solidarity. And of course, it's important to speak up like that. But I actually think to bring about long-term change, we have to actually change the structures of all these organizations. And I think mentorship and, you know, things like that are just so key.
Yeah, no, I mean, I completely agree. When I spoke to Courtney, I was like, this has hit the nail on the head completely. Because, I mean, there's been some great initiatives to come out of what's going on now. Like a lot of, I mean, I've seen some scholarships. Like there's one at Listen Gallery to help Black students study at Columbia. And there's like some from like a gallery, Carl Costial, who's doing a sort of a scheme to... give a scholarship to some Black students as well. And whilst that's incredible, putting your money where your mouth is great, but mentorship is free. Anyone can do it. And I think I love the idea of removing the sort of competitive nature of these roles and sort of, you know, looking towards a successor and cultivating the next generation as you're doing it is such a forward-thinking move. If every director of every institution identified somebody that they really believed in and cultivated them, imagine what the art world would look like in as soon as 20 or 30 years. I think it would be amazing. I hope that that message comes through to a lot of people. It's also exciting.
It is.
And you can do it at so many different stages. I can start doing it at my very early stage if there's like a student at the Courtauld or whatever. I would love to do that. There's like a sense of giving back that I think is important, and I think sometimes we forget that sense because we're in, especially in the art world, but career-wise, you're always jumping towards your next hurdle and trying to sort of usurp, or not really usurp, but like take over. But then there's a lot more to be said about sort of bringing other people along and creating real change.
I also feel like in order to reflect the world we live in right now, like you have to have that change, because otherwise museums and galleries are going to be completely irrelevant to the audience, you know, because the audience now has changed. You know, we are all thinking differently. And like, you know, the younger generations, you know, even the generation younger than you, say, like they completely think differently. Do you know what I mean? On all kinds of issues.
They're
more politically engaged. They are not going to go to the Tate anymore. They're not going to go to these museums if they don't catch up, you know, all of these different institutions.
And that was really shown during the recent protests, like seeing all these young people really politically engaged, know their facts with these signs. I was like, these people aren't going to be going to these institutions if they don't reflect on what's going on. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah,
exactly. Well, it's just about recontextualizing the narrative going forwards. And it makes me think of like artists like Jordan Castile, who's got a massive show at the New Museum, and who one of her main drives for creating work and making these figurative works of people in the community is to see them on gallery walls. And her mantra is literally like, if art's for everyone, then everyone needs to be seen within art. You have to see yourself up there to know yourself. And that's the importance, and that's the responsibility of the art world now, or anyone in culture, to show that diversity.
Yeah, and museums sort of, I've read lots of reports and like museums complaining about demographics not being diverse enough, and I don't see why they don't see the connection between if they can't see themselves on the walls. There's, you know, there's still that sense of, I know there's a lot of people that find art quite difficult to approach because there's all these sort of pre-doctrine sort of ideas of how you're supposed to appreciate art, how you're supposed to exist within the museum space, and breaking that down and creating something a bit more inclusive and a bit more familiar for many people will be a great way to get different people through the doors and continue to get people through the doors as the generations change.
Mm. Well, you said in your article about how some institutions you felt took too long to respond to the Black Lives Matters after George Floyd's death, and you say that some still haven't. And there's a term in there called virtue signalling, which I've seen, it's kind of become the zeitgeist phrase that I see around a lot. What exactly is that, and how do you feel like these institutions are backtracking, or are they coming to the forefront now? Or do you feel like there's a that they're it's working, that people are saying to them, come on, sort yourself out?
I think in the beginning there was probably a bit of a knee-jerk reaction, because I think in the beginning there was people didn't know how to engage with what was going on, whether it was their place, especially their commercial galleries. I think the argument they would say is that they're not cultural institutions, they're just, you know, commercial galleries. Do they need to respond? And I think it became very clear after many other galleries taking this on that it's something they need to do. The idea of virtue signaling, I think, is more them posting something because everyone else is doing it, and if they don't do it, they look bad. If all the galleries in London are posting solidarity and you don't, and you post because everyone else is doing it, is it really, really solidarity? And so that's what that was the main point. There's still a few places that have commented. I don't know the politics of each place, and I can't really get into analysing each sort of institution. But I think that's the idea of virtue signalling. But I think a lot of people have been roused by the conversation and what might have started as, okay, we need to get this up because this is what's going on now and this is what we're doing, has moved on to conversations of actually let's try and do something. And within the weeks since the article's been published, I've spoken to some people at auction houses, at galleries, who've asked me about how they think they should be instituting change within their institutions. And I've also know other people who have been speaking. They've been reaching out as well. And great. I do think that there is a change that's going to happen. Or at least I hope so. But I don't know. This movement feels different to, I mean, Black Lives Matter happened, it's always happening. They always matter. Yeah. But the movement happened with Trayvon Martin maybe 4 years ago. Yeah. And that, I just didn't stick as much as I feel the conversations are sticking now. I'm intrigued about why that is the case. I have a theory that COVID has sort of made everyone realize that it's been an equalizer and there's been a sort of sense of compassion that has roused in everyone.
Everyone's on the same page suddenly. Everyone's experiencing this. So we'll have a common denominator now, which we never really had before, of this thing that has united the whole planet. So it does then feel like we're all the fucking same. So why can't
I also just feel that people weren't as distracted, because I think if you actually think about how busy everyone's everyday life is and how, yes, you pick up the newspaper if you're in London on the train, for example, on the tube, and you see everyone reading the newspaper. But a lot of the time, people just don't actually want to have to confront difficult issues that deeply. They kind of want to know what's going on, and then they want to go and get their coffee, or they want to go to work, or they've got a million things going on. And I think having that kind of time to slow down and kind of actually have to face yourself in your house for months on end, like, has meant that people are responding to this differently without a doubt. I mean, because, you know, it's...
I definitely don't think it's a coincidence.
No, definitely not.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
The other thing that I found really fascinating in your article was this idea of, I think, the Black Artists and Modernism National Collection Audit that happened. When did it happen? Was it a few years ago or something?
I can't remember the date off the top of my head, but like maybe within the last decade it happened.
Okay, yeah. So they did a kind of analysis of all the UK's permanent collections, and they found only 2,000 works by Black artists. It wasn't only kind of disappointing that there's so few works by Black artists in UK permanent collections, but it was also the idea that most of these 2,000 works aren't even on display. And how the hell is anything going to change if there's no canon of Black art? And, you know, we recently interviewed Lebena Hamid, and she spoke about the challenges she's experienced for the last kind of almost 40 years now. Mm. And she's a total pioneer in so many ways. And I was touched by her kind of discussion with us about how curators often might want to invite a Black artist to, you know, be seen in an exhibition, but then they'll never ask you to go for coffee, or they'll never, you know, say let's go for lunch. And without actually getting to know artists on a personal level and engage with their lives, you're not actually going to fully understand the art or the capability or possibility of what these artists, you know, what artists are actually able to create.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I feel maybe there's a, I don't know whether there's a disconnect or a fear for some curators about how to engage in these topics. But I think this is something that is going to be changing now. I mean, we've seen reading lists like the book of Why I'm Not Talking About, Talking to White People About Race, soared to the top of the bestseller. I think people hopefully are starting to educate themselves in issues of race. And I think with that, hopefully more conversations and more intelligent curation and involving of Black artists within exhibitions should happen. Because there's also, I mean, a lot of people will sort of say, okay, let's get more Black curators to curate Black art. But that's a bit too simple. I think that there should be also other curators should be interested in issues of race, or as a Black curator, I would love to curate other shows as well about other topics too. I think
totally.
I understand the idea of creating a Black scholarship, but I think it should eventually become a bit more intermingled. And I get the sort of idea that because I'm Black, I have the sort of sensitivity and knowledge of being Black to understand Black art, but kind of, I mean, I'm still just a girl from London. I don't know everything about Black history too. I think that's also a conversation of who approaches issues of race. Can white artists paint Black people? I mean, people have asked me that a lot. I think it's a duty as an ally to sort of engage with what's going on currently. Then some other people might disagree. It's still a very, I think we're still learning and trying to figure out what is okay and what is necessary. But I think the main point should be that we should make mistakes and learn.
And I also think it's really important not to just shut things down, because there's been this whole kind of cancel culture in the last, you know, 5 years or so, where things just get shut down. And I feel like if an artist is going to show solidarity and togetherness through their work, you know, in the idiom of what they do, then and you know, and it's true to it and it doesn't seem cynical, and if they're trying to, like, I don't know, raise money for charities or just even show that, you know, solidarity in itself, it's really important, because different artists have different audiences, which will then be educated, you know. But I, the other thing I find really interesting is this thing of, like, if you think at the moment of, like, the kind of black artists that we're getting to see in museums, the vast majority of them are often making figurative art, which, you know, are kind of, you know, depicting black people actually figuratively in the paintings. But then there's also loads and loads and loads and loads of black artists, you know, from the UK alone, who are making work that you never see a figure in, and make all kinds of work, abstract art, you know, video art, all
and
kinds of
art. People are very surprised by that.
But it's not
surprising.
Which I think
is very interesting.
Yeah, and that's also what I think galleries, commercial galleries, need to get their head around, is that you can't just sort of represent, you know, a figurative painter. You need to sort of approach all artists in, you know, artists make all kinds of work, and that all needs to have a platform.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, I think I touched on this on the in the article too, or maybe I spoke to, I think Eva Langret posted, wrote about it, about how there's this sort of idea of black figuration existing within the art world. Actually, no, it's Osei Bonsu. And because it is part of the canon of art history, like, figuration is probably the most focal, most identifiable aspect of painting for most people. And so for many, just changing that and editing it by, you know, by changing the color of the skin is probably the easiest access point for many. But I think it's more challenging and more rewarding in general to understand that to be a black artist and not make art about being black.
Yeah, exactly. And if you think of someone like, I don't know, like Frank Bowling, for example, who makes abstract painting, like me too. And I've had the privilege to work with him in the last year, and we're working again together at the moment. And he's just so visionary, and so he was so kind of singular in many ways, because in the 60s, you know, when he was studying at the Royal College, like, he was pretty much one of the only black artists there. And I love the fact that he kind of dedicated his life to what he loved, which was abstract painting, you know. And anyway, that's just one tiny element. And I don't mean to minimize figurative art either, because of course, like you say, it's incredibly important.
People doing that.
But but in the last year, you know, Imre Basiakon's installation at Chisenhale and at Derry and Void in Derry, like, that there was no figuration in that exhibition, but combination of materials, the whole concept behind it was to do with the bodies and marginalized voices and all of these topics, but through a completely kind of abstracted, you know, sculptural installation in a way. And that was one of the most powerful things I've ever seen in art. So that's all I'm trying to say, is that I think
you look in the States, for like, there's a lot of artists in the States that are really, and this seems like there's a better support system as well for black artists in the States through artists like Kehinde Wiley has the Black Rock Senegal residency, and there's all these things, and there's a lot of artists out there, like, say, Mark Bradford, who is making these incredible works, Glenn Ligon, who again are making work that aren't figurative, but they're just it's really important. But it would be amazing if we could have more residencies here like they do in the States. Can you see that happening more?
I think it should happen more. I think I've been thinking about the difference between America and the UK in terms of black art. I think a lot of the names that I've been sort of coming across in my research and my revisiting of artists, there's a lot more American ones. And I know it's a bigger place, and there was a different movement, but I think the reception and sort of the prolificness of black art is bigger in America. And I would love to see it translate more to the UK, which is why I want to start a studio museum in Harlem in the UK, Museum London or something like that.
So this is something you're definitely like, this is something that you have to focus on. And this, and when can you see this sort of happening and coming together? Because this residency you set up with Oliette, the Plop residency, seems incredible. And I guess that's just the next transition, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've been thinking so much about how I would love to sort of action my own change. And I've been thinking about curatorial projects, which I'm starting to get into conversation with, in, you know, when things can start happening properly. But I think... From my conversations with artists, black artists, what we need is more black spaces, and that is something that I think is important and something I'd love to engage with. There are spaces to see Black art in London and specifically, and ones that are definitely more akin to allying with that sort of vision.
Like where would they be for people to find?
South London Gallery does really great stuff to that respect. Chisenhale also, I mean, the director Zoe Whiteley is incredible and engages with these topics regularly. Those are probably the two main things. Two main spaces I would point people
to. Camden Arts Centre's Camden Arts Centre's been really supportive. Like Cara Walker's had shows there, and they have residency. Walter Price is another African American artist that had a residency there recently. I think
Camden needs more sort of recognition than it gets as well. It's such a great space.
Those
spaces are brilliant. I have this sort of, maybe it's a mad dream, but I would love something like Student Museum Harlem in London, because not only do they do great shows, but they produce incredible academics. Like there's Legacy Russell, who I'm obsessed with, who's the associate curator, and she does everything she does. I'm like, okay, wow. Cool.
She's awesome. I used to know her when she was in London, actually. She's so cool.
Yeah, she's produced stuff here.
I don't think that's a dream, though. I think that can be a reality, and where there is a permanent collection of rotating Black British art, and then you have the residencies there for British, UK-based Black artists or international to go and live in London and study and be surrounded by that. I think that's not a dream. I think that has to be reality, and I think that is exactly what you should be doing.
You heard it here first.
Yes, but I think that's what you should be doing. I think it should be. I don't see why that can't be a thing that's going to happen in the near future.
I think it would really also change people's perceptions of what Black British art could be.
Exactly.
How it can change, how it can develop.
It's visibility. That's what it needs to be.
Many of the artists I know just had interesting experiences at art school because the visibility isn't there as well. It would be a great support network and also a great sort of hub for thinking and change. Okay, I'll do
it. It'd be inspiring. It'd be like a place that it champions everything, and it's like an inspiring space that, again, it's like mentorship, seeing figures within the art world. But if you see a space that is predominantly there to celebrate Black art, Black culture, then you've got this, you go like, well, I can be in there. That's where I want to be. I want to be doing that. I want to be on the wall in there. That's do you know what I mean? That's what needs to happen now. Oh, I'm red up. I'm into it.
You're like, all right.
I'm into it.
Can I ask you a question? How do you, because I noticed that you were obviously very strong individual. Like, I feel like you've got a real strength of character that you seem to have had from a very young age. You know, you wrote in the Financial Times at the age of 20, and I heard you describe yourself once as precocious, which I thought was actually quite funny in a way, because you do have this kind of very strong confidence. Can you give any advice to like other people who might struggle with public speaking, or even just kind of, you know, getting how they feel out into the world? Because I think you're obviously a very unique person, but I also feel like you've probably like grown all those skills and developed them.
It's definitely developed. I can also be quite shy as well, which is, if people find, quite surprising. I think there's something that sort of I can light switch and then be like, you know, bubbly Andrea, and then sort of can also be quite introverted in my reading. But in terms of owning what you want, I think it's just, where does it come from? It comes from just, I guess, realizing that it's, I don't know why it's been drilled into us like we should maybe be a bit more ashamed about being so forthcoming with what we desire and what we'd like to achieve. I think we're, I don't know how, but we're taught this sort of, oh, you must wait,
be humble,
pay your dues, or be
that's
humble.
The British thing.
I think it's probably British, because when I'm in America,
I'm like,
oh, wait.
No. we go to America and we're like, whoa, all right, Big Ed. We're like, chill out. But here it's like you got to hide your light under a bushel, is what they say. It's like you just have
and
to
sort of like
stay humble.
Quietly sort of wait. But I just sort of was like, no, I don't. I mean, I'm also a bit impatient sometimes, so I was like, I'm not waiting. And the only bad thing that can happen is someone says no, and then you move on. Yeah. I guess the biggest hurdle, I guess, is not being offended when someone says no. And once you get over that, then you can just keep asking. And if you ask enough, someone's going to say yes. And that's kind of what happened with Financial Times. I just emailed twice. And then, I mean, luckily I'm a good writer, so that also helps. But yeah, I just was very forthright with being ambitious. And I think not enough people are. And some people find that charming. Some people might find it annoying, but hopefully most people find it charming about being pretty just honest about what you want. And yeah, I think that's my only main advice. I hope it's good though.
Well, yeah, just grab life by the balls. Just like go for it, head down, exactly. And then eye on the prize. It's blinkered. And yeah. I feel like, especially in culture, and you will get rejection and people will tell you aren't good enough. And I know that myself. And from being an actor, it's like you're constantly being rejected, but then you learn from that and you adapt. And that's what we do as creative people. So I think I think you're inspiring.
Also, asking for help has been good. Like, I think a lot of people find it scary to ask for help. Some of the best things I've done have been from, I'll write something and then I'll maybe give it to a friend and they might be like, oh, what about this? You should read this book. And then that will completely rechange like my thoughts. There's a sort of sense of stubbornness that I think maybe a lot of people have. I think I probably have it too, in that asking for help is a sign of weakness. I think it's not. I think it's the opposite.
Yeah, that's very good advice. Yeah.
Good. Great. Well, we ask every guest that comes on, as you know, as you've listened to Talk Heart, to very special testing questions that reveal a lot about your personality. The first one is, if you could do an imaginary art heist, you could steal any artwork in the world for yourself and it's completely fine, you won't go to prison, what would that be and why?
I think I would choose Caravaggio's Supper at Emmaus in the National Gallery. One, I think it'd be incredibly fun to break into the National Gallery. I'd have like a full sort of Bond girl outfit, like trick the guards, like hovering from the ceiling. Nice. I've imagined the whole heist now. It's very good, very chic. But it's also one of the first paintings that really made me fall in love with art and its possibilities. It's really cinematic. It's like a Scorsese. But yeah, one of my favorite paintings. Caravaggio is also such a inspiration, and I really enjoy his work. I think it's very overdue another show of Caravaggio. So
is it permanently hung at the National Gallery? Is it permanently there?
It is permanently hung, yeah. It changes place sometimes, but it's always there.
What's happening in the scene?
There's all these figures, and it's like it's got the chiaroscuro light and dark, so that's what creates the cinematic sort of sense. It's a biblical scene, but it looks so contemporary. Yeah, that's the most fascinating. It's not the scene that's fascinating. It's the way it's been rendered. And it's just really dramatic. You know, there's the supper and how it's lit. And it's, I don't know, it's something that entrances me every time I see it. And I think a lot of people will go for other Caravaggios more than this one. But yeah, it's just very, very poignant and I just love it.
Great. Good thing about National Gallery is it's free. So anyone could just pop in an lunch break after listening to this, or maybe listening to Talk Art and go and stand in front of it while we're talking about it.
They can go and scope it out and work out how to help us do the art heist.
Exactly. I appreciate tips.
the other question we ask every guest is, what is your favourite colour?
Gosh, I was just saying, but it's pink. I resist it because I think it's just so obvious, but I just like light baby pink. I'm still a little girl. It's very feminine. It's good. But yeah, I'll be honest. I should have said something like inky jet black because it reminds me of like my soul. But no, pink.
do you collect, Andrea? Do you collect?
I do. I started collecting. I'm still very much in the beginnings, but my friend Ollie Epp is a really good collector and he's been encouraging me for a while. So I'm getting into it and I've got a lot of emerging artists on my to-do list. So I'm going to make my way
through. Who are your top three emerging British artists we should be kind of on our radar right now?
Emerging is a difficult word, but Jade Fadejitimi, I adore. Do you know her work?
No, tell me about that.
She's a black artist, but she does abstraction. But it's incredibly visceral, sort of like brushstrokes are just very, they're dragged across the canvas. It's it's just very evocative, really large scale canvases. She's with Pippi Holdsworth. Who else do I enjoy? Emerging.
We just interviewed Cassie Nomoda, who had a solo first kind of big show at Pippi Holdsworth's gallery.
Oh, yeah, she did.
They have an incredible program. Yes. I'm really into it. Yes. Other artists, I mean, I'm very biased, but Ollie Epp does incredible work. I've seen it grow. I think it's got all these beautiful dark themes and humour. And then,
they're kind of like post-internet-y, aren't they? Post-internet, kind of like
it's
airbrushy.
It's the style that I think,
Photoshop-y
style. The style, I think, works really well. But it's also rendered very beautifully. Like, there's a lot of photorealism sort of patches on the canvas, which I think doesn't translate over screen very well. But, yeah, so that's two. And I think I'm trying to think of a sculptor or something not painting related.
When do you think you're going to get your residency back up then? I mean, you can't really tell, can you? But have you got plans to do it again next year?
I would love to do it. I think it might make sense to just start again next year. I was going to think of maybe doing it at the end of this year, but maybe just start afresh in 2021 and see how that goes.
Just saying, the residency where you set up with Ollie, you're saying it gives these artists, three artists per month, this residency space for free. There's access to accommodation. It's in Soho in the centre of London. And there's no application fee. It's free to enter, open to all. And you've had that funded for a year, and then hopefully you're going to get it. You've got it funded for another year. So if anybody's looking for a residency and or like a studio space, and they haven't got any money, this is a really good place to apply to, right?
It is. I love when artists DM me as well and ask about the residency and the tips. And it's very much a very informal residency. We hang out, we have pizza nights, we go to clubs as well. It's a very social and fun one because it's just me and Ollie, and we just really immerse them in London. So that's
it's like going to Ibiza for my last art.
Yeah. I got my last artist. I love Rosie Hastings and Hannah Quinlan.
We are massive fans.
Oh, they're so good. I saw they got nominated for the Jarman Prize.
Jarman Prize.
Which is great. So thrilled. Yeah.
So they currently have a show at the Focal Point Gallery in Southend, which has obviously been closed down for the moment, but that's extended now. The show was meant to move around, but it's now still at Focal Point. So I'm going to be up there as soon as possible. And then they have a solo coming up later on the year in Europe. And we love them. We absolutely like. They've been former guests of Talkart, and I'm a massive champion of them. I think they're amazing.
They've got great energy, and they're just lovely.
Yes.
So, and I love the work. So I'd be very proud.
Me too.
To have one at some point. So those are my top three. I mean, I could go on forever, which is why I find it difficult to distill into three. But there's some great art happening at the moment, and I'm looking forward to going through all the online showcases too.
Definitely. Yeah.
There is one other thing I wanted to ask you about, which is Matt's Gallery, because I saw that you were a patron there and you've been very supportive to Matt's Gallery. Can you speak a bit about Matt's? Because I think it's such a classic kind of institution in a way. I love Matt's Gallery.
Yeah, I love Matt's Gallery too. And I feel that it needs more visibility, especially with maybe my demographic. I've spoken to a lot of my friends about Matt's and they didn't realise the history. I mean, Robert Klasnick has been at the forefront of supporting contemporary and emerging artists since, I don't know, I guess like the 80s or a long time. And his taste is incredible. And it's such a supportive and warm network of artists. They've just been renovating and changing space into Nine Elms. But I guess that's also on hold. But when it is open, it will be an incredible dedication to all the work that Robin has done. Matt is not the name of the person. That is Robin's dog, which is a good thing to clarify. A lot of people are like, who's
Legend.
Matt? Like,
yeah,
no,
where's Matt?
Matt?
Can I meet Matt? Yeah.
There's no Matt. It's Robin. But yeah, it's a great place. And I've met the most incredible artists there and really enjoyed sort of championing what they do and trying. I really just want to engage the next generation in the legacy of Matt. And hope to continue to do so. It's brilliant.
Awesome.
Well, I think you're engaging next generation yourself. And I feel like we're going to be seeing so much more of you in the future. And I can't wait for us to...
I really hope we actually get to hang out as well. I want to see you. And I saw that last year...
Yeah, I want to hang.
Yeah, I saw that last year you went to my friend Raymond and Paul's house and got to hold a Franz West in your hand, one of the adaptive works.
I did. That was really cool. I was.
You were like, it's the biggest perk of my job.
I was there like, if I break this, I don't think I'm ever going to be invited to anyone's house. But yeah, no, it was, yeah, that was great.
Amazing.
I'm really looking forward to interacting with art and with my arty friends again. So, awesome. Totally. All this to look forward to.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming on. For all images we're talking about today, please go to the @TallCart on Instagram. And Andrea, you're on Instagram. What is your handle, please?
It's Andrea London, but A-I-N-D-R-E-A, because my parents like to spell things interestingly.
And you can find out more about the Plop Residency as well at plop-residency.com. And we will link to all the artists and works that we've discussed today at Talk Art. Thank you for listening, and we love you. It's been
Thank
so,
so
fun to talk to you. Thank you.
Bye.
And we'll be back soon.
Everyone.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diament and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.